This is Juliette Kayyem with the Security Mom Podcast, brought to you by WGBH News. 15 years since the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, it seems remarkable in so many ways, the passage of time measured by our children getting older, our parents getting older, and the passage of time and careers and choices and houses and everything that happens in 15 years. The nation has also changed. We tend to think of a before and after, as if September 10th, 2001 was the last day of peace, and afterwards we've been in perpetual war. The reality is more complicated, and for most of us, especially for those of us who have lost loved ones on that day, life has moved on. But 15 years gives us a time to reflect on where we were and where we are and what has happened in between. And I thought the best person to talk to about that is none other than former governor and former Secretary of Homeland Security, the first one, Tom Ridge. Governor Ridge was governor on September 11th, 2001, when Todd Beamer and the other passengers on United Airlines Flight 93 tried to stop the hijacking. And in Todd's famous words, "Let's roll," tried to stop the plane from harming others. The plane crashed and killed everyone in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, sort of marking a significant event for Tom Ridge himself. By the end of the week, Ridge would no longer be governor. He gave up his duties at the State House, moved to D.C., and joined the Bush administration in its war against terror, first as the Homeland Security Advisor, a new position for President Bush, and then as the first Secretary of Homeland Security. On September 11th, 2001, you were governor of Pennsylvania, and I think, like this nation, that had a tremendous impact on your career, who you were. And I think people would love to hear from you about sort of what that day meant. And by the end of the week, you were no longer governor. You had moved to D.C.
Well, you know, I think anyone that was five or six years of age on September 11, 2001, remembers that day very vividly. And unfortunately, even in our schools, they had the scenes of the Twin Towers falling and the Pentagon burning. So we were all affected. I think the country was affected. I think since 9/11, we understood it was an attack on our way of life, but it also gave us a chance to demonstrate our character, our courage, our resiliency. And so as we get closer to September 11th, we start assessing where we've gone in the past 15 years. Are we safer? We are. But the actors are different. The nature of the threats are different. And what we felt was an isolated scourge, an isolated problem with a limited group of terrorists, has become a global scourge. And frankly, I think it's a permanent condition that the world writ large is going to have to deal with forevermore. But I think we have to put it in the context of it is serious. So there's a physical and a psychic effect with a terrorist attack. But let's be serious about putting it in the context of other risks and threats to us in our daily lives. And it's one that we can deal with. And I don't mean to prolong the conversation or to minimize the terrorist attack, but Labor Day weekend, 400 or 500 people died in telephone and in traffic accidents. The National Safety Council estimated there were about 38,000 people who died in traffic accidents. So let's take the risk of a terrorist attack and put it in perspective. Not that we don't do everything we can to avoid it, but let's appreciate it in context of everything else we do in America.
And, I mean, that's exactly one of the things about your book, when you talk about those early days, in fact, or months, when you left the State House, you feel compelled, you know, to join an administration that clearly is going to be defined by this moment. You describe a meeting, and I hope for my listeners, I found it to be one of the most amazing meetings, maybe just a month after 9/11, where the president shows some concern about, you know, Fortress America, right? That vis-a-vis Mexico and Canada.
Well, you know, he did, but he also, remember him pulling me aside, actually, yeah. and saying, we've got friends to the north and to the south. We've been very blessed as a country to have that, notwithstanding some other challenges associated that are very much part of the political conversation these days. But the fact of the matter is our economies are interconnected, our cultures in many ways are interconnected. And what we need to do is sit down in a very thoughtful, responsible way, figure out a way to enhance our security without jeopardizing the economic and cultural relationships that we have. And to that end, as Secretary of Homeland Security, we went on to build a rigorous smart border accord with our friends in Canada, and not one quite as rigorous as with our friends in Mexico. But the notion is that this is a risk. It is it's a global threat now, and we do our best when we work together to identify it and to hopefully prevent it, but then to be in a position to help one another to respond in the event something occurs. So
the story in Tom Ridge's book about his years with the Bush administration is really remarkable. It's just about a month after September 11th, and President Bush sort of excuses the rest of his cabinet or national security team and asks Tom Ridge to stay. Bush has heard from the president of Mexico, the prime minister of Canada at the time, and the borders are blocked, right? Fortress America is not good for commerce. And Bush says to Tom Ridge, we have to let go a little. That's remarkable words from a president just a month after September 11th, and a president not known for letting go a little. But I think it shows how early on the challenge of how you protect this homeland is not an easy answer.
And I would say this to you as well, Juliet. I was privileged that the president asked me, but I dare say you ended up at Homeland Security. Yeah. You understand when somebody asks you to do something in the midst of the drama, the horror, the significance of that day, everybody would have said yes if the president called them. I can't imagine an American turning down their president, whether Republican, Democrat, Independent. I need you to help me. The only answer you give a man is, yes, sir, Mr. President, how can I help? Real simple.
Yeah. No, that's right. And I think, I mean, the challenge you had, different from any subsequent Secretary of Homeland Security, is, I mean, you had a startup. I mean, essentially, this thing is created. And, you know, it seems inconceivable how you would even think about starting a new federal agency, right? I mean, and... how did you think about it from day to day, just from a management perspective?
Well, you know, it's a great way. I really appreciate the way you phrased that, the inquiry, because it was a very large startup, but very few startups begin with about 180,000 people. So
yeah.
What we try to internalize when we're building out this new cabinet agency was that Homeland Security was actually the whole company. Mm-hmm. And underneath the holding company, you had Customs and Border Protection, you had the Coast Guard, you had pre-existing agencies, some of whom were happy to come to the DHS, many of whom weren't happy to leave their longstanding relationships with other departments. So what I found was most interesting and important the first year or two as we were trying to build out the build out the enterprise and bring some rationality to human resources, to budgeting, to logistics, and everything you can imagine is finance, everything you can imagine with a huge startup with billions of dollars in spending and 180,000 people. Is there was a tie that bind that we're all in it together. Same team, same fight. And so I think everyone got through a very difficult first year or two knowing that roles that they had before dealing with goods and services across the border, which previously not too many people paid attention to, suddenly those ICE agents, suddenly those Border Patrol agents, suddenly those Coast Guard folks, suddenly those TSA folks, boy, they really are important to my country and certainly important to my security. So it was an interesting, and frankly, they're still working at making it, streamlining it, but the tie that kept us together during the first year or two was a notion we're all in this together to make our country safer.
And when looking back now, what's the one thing that you wish, you know, especially in the creation of the department, had been done differently, whether it's a piece that would have been in or out, or, I mean, you know, people look at it now and they, you know, think, oh, it's a hodgepodge and TSA agents. But there was actually a thought process, some thought process to building this thing. Looking back now, almost 15 or a little bit less than 15 years, because DHS was later. If you said, gosh, I wish I could have just not had that or had that, what would it be?
If I could do one, only one reorg, one change, at the same time the Congress authorized the creation of the department, if Congress would have reorganized itself in terms of its oversight of the department, I mean, yours truly, secretaries that followed me, the deputy secretaries, we show up and have to spend so much time on the Hill, and I'm not whining, I'm not complaining, but the oversight that we could have used and still could use is dispersed all over Congressional Hill. So if they were going to do one thing to accelerate the development and the maturity of the agency itself, is that they would have reconstructed themselves, become a legislative partner in nurturing to fulfillment the legislative, this new cabinet agency. I was on the Hill, and my deputies were on the Hill, but me personally testified more often in the first 2 years than Don Rumsfeld did, and he had two wars going on.
Wow.
And so, and people, unless you've been on the Hill, don't understand, there's a lot of work that goes into that. And so if I was had one do-over, the one new addition is Congress, reconstitute yourself so you don't have all my key people running back and forth every other day to testify and spend hours answering questions that you send 17, 20-page letters. So that's what I've done.
No, I think a lot of people hear this complaint and they think, oh, they just don't like being on the Hill. But really, if oversight's supposed to be successful, you would have a unified legislative agenda. You would have a budget that you could have confidence in. You'd be treated like an adult agency rather than I often call DHS the PS, right? You know, DOD, CIA, FBI, and then, oh, yeah, DHS, you know, or DOJ.
People that they talk about, we tried to do it. I mean, John Boehner said, I tried to do it. Listen, I can say this because I was on the Hill for 12 years as a member of Congress before I became governor. Everybody whines and complains about the number of committees and subcommittees they're on, but God forbid you try to make them close or merge some of those committees of jurisdiction, and there's all hell to pay.
So before you left, and maybe this is a little bit of setting the record straight or however much you want to talk about it, there was a big controversy about a statement that you made about the color alert system going into the election. We haven't revisited that for almost 10 years, and but I do know it took even the Obama administration committed to ending the color code with your support and Michael Chertoff's support. It still took us 2 years because how hard it is to dismantle things. But, you know, what was your... The color code is how so many people think of the post 9/11 world. What's your sort of takeaway now, you know, a decade later?
Well, there is no takeaway. If any succeeding administration wants to change it, that's fine. I think you have to be flexible enough to do it. But again, putting that decision in the context, and apparently I didn't do a good enough job because it did become the subject of a lot of late night talk shows and the like, but I'm a big boy, I can take it. By the way, humor is not a bad way of getting across some very, very difficult subjects. But here's the deal. The first couple of times that Bob Mueller, FBI director, and John Ashcroft and I would go out based on threat information and give a general alert to the public, I remember coming down from the podium and saying, that's just great. We told everybody, the intelligence community thinks that threats are imminent. They're really serious. Be alert. Be aware. Have a good day. We haven't told you anything.
Yeah.
And so I remember stepping down from the podium, and the two great military people seconded to me from the Department of Defense. And I said, we need to come up with a system to identify not only the level of threat, but a system that says, depending on the level of threat, there are certain prescribed security protocols you best put in place. So for every color level, there is a level of security. And the federal agencies developed that. And we did that. Mm-hmm. So we could say, and we did it so that it could be surgically applied. I think we used it once or twice on with regard to aviation. I think we used it once with regard to financial services. And so you had the different colors reflecting not only the level of threat, but the mandated security protocols you're supposed to put in place. A couple of years later, they decided to abandon it, go to a couple of Word documents. I don't find fault with anybody, but people were saying, okay, tell us what the level of threat is, but more, tell us what to do about it. And I guess that message never got across, because if there were certain, again, prescribed security protocols at each level, some followed them, some didn't. I would do it all over again.
Yeah.
But so be it.
Right. No, I mean, I think we've come full circle, you know. This idea that people want to be empowered.
I like to think at the time it was more reassuring.
Yeah.
But here's what the public doesn't know. You know this, and I know this. The public doesn't know this. When we met, the President Bush, by executive order, had a Homeland Security Committee. It was about two-thirds of the existing cabinet. And before I ever went in to say to the president, we need to raise the level of threat, or we need to publicly identify a threat and take it to a certain level, there had to be agreement within that group. And we met far more often and said, the threat is not significant, the information is not credible enough, or whatever. I mean, it was a thorough assessment. And so what the public never realized, even though we may have raised the threat level 4 or 5 times, we met 2x, 3x, 5x times more often and said, no, it doesn't warrant alarming the public.
Yeah.
So in retrospect, that was a good combination. And I think it served the purpose at the time, and Secretary Chertoff and others decided to change it, so be it.
So a little bit later, you're out as the secretary, but at least in the history of the 15 years since 9/11, there's another moment which meant a lot for the department and its failure in some ways, and that's Hurricane Katrina. I often say, you know, if 9/11 created Homeland Security, Katrina was a little bit of a course correction. Sort of standing on the outside, and you're also in the private sector now, you know, what is the meaning of Katrina, a different kind of hazard, and how did that change the way you think about our Homeland Security?
First of all, you probably don't know this, but when I was a young congressman in 1985, 3 tornadoes bounced around my congressional district, and the second disaster to show up after Mother Nature was FEMA. So I spent a couple of years rewriting the FEMA law. It's called the Stafford Act.
Yeah.
I wasn't on any committee, but we got that passed. So I'm a partisan. I love FEMA. It's a great organization. The volunteers do great work. Katrina, there was nothing that anybody could have foreseen or done about the break of the levees. I understand that. And the people pound on the Corps of Engineers, but it was a rather remarkable confluence of natural weather events. My heartburn about Katrina is that long before Katrina, my staff and I had worked on a response plan because we anticipated that there might come a time when the nature of the disaster, remember, it's an all-hazard agency, whether it was a terrorist event, a horrible accident, or a natural weather event, that the consequences and the needs to deal with the disaster would exceed that of the local government, the state government, and traditional federal government. So we created a national response plan that, candidly, I'm going to say this, and that was ignored at the time. It would have called for putting Thad Allen in place before the incident, not after. So what I think happened here is that people were overconfident in their abilities to deal with it and didn't execute a game plan that was sitting on the shelf in anticipation of a horrific disaster. The New Orleans is under sea level as we talk today, and you got a Cat 4, Cat 5 storm heading to it. We should have erred on the side of prevention and deployed assets down there long before, but it didn't happen. And there was some criticism of the plan. Frankly, I don't really criticize the plan. I think the failure to execute some kind of precautionary preventive measures prior to the plan has as much to do, couldn't solidify the levees. They were going to break, but the response was slow and it tainted the administration for the balance of President Bush's time in office, and I think it was a shame because there's certain things that could have been done in anticipation of the storm that weren't done, and it just complicated things once the storm passed.
I want to just stop a moment and talk about Hurricane Katrina and what Governor Ridge just mentioned. It is true that if 9/11 sort of was the creation of this notion of homeland security, at least in the modern era, Hurricane Katrina was its course correction. It was a recognition by those of us in the field that a nation that focused so much exclusively on one threat, in that case, Al-Qaeda, you know, more specifically stopping 19 guys from getting on 4 airplanes and killing lots of Americans, if we focused too much on that one threat, we were surely going to neglect other vulnerabilities. And we were surely not going to nurture our response and recovery and resiliency capabilities. Now, why Hurricane Katrina happened in terms of its response is going to be debated for years to come. But Tom Ridge does mention an important aspect to America, or at least the federal government's failures. There was a catastrophic plan. There was recognition within the bureaucracy that something big could happen, of sort of global, you know, biblical proportions. And the plan was not deployed. The resources were not there. We waited too long. We did not surge. We were not on the ground. And people died. So I want to maybe move forward a little bit. There's now been 4 secretaries of Homeland Security, and you opened with this and just mentioned to it this idea of all hazards. I mean, obviously terrorism is different, but a large federal agency that deals with state and locals and their preparedness planning, like, you know, you have to be prepared for everything. And so, you know, if you were writing what you would like the next 15 years to look like, because we don't know what the threats will be or whatever, I mean, what are some of the gaps that you think we still need to address, recognizing Congress hasn't fixed itself, and how can American citizens think about our homeland security in the next 15 years?
Well, I think it's there are some gaps that I think the public is probably at least aware of or sensitive to, and there's a couple that we need to pay attention to. The most obvious ones in mind is there's still some information sharing lapses between the federal government and local government. We're much better than we were 15 years ago, but there's still room for improvement. I don't think we should underestimate the challenges associated with what I consider to be 2 of the biggest threats. That's a dirty bomb or a biohazard. I worked on a project with Senator Joe Lieberman, a biodefense group, and we concluded that we're ill-prepared, whether Mother Nature or the terrorists. So those are the 2 dominant threats. And you got cyber terrorism. Those are, people think about that a lot, but there are a couple. There's one threat that one vulnerability that I think is both a can be exploited by terrorists, but also could be at the could be a public health threat. And since Homeland Security has to deal with a wide range of threats, and frankly, that is what has happened in a global economy connected by the internet and the e-commerce, and the number of packages that we get coming into the United States every day about which we know nothing about the contents. And so I think, you know, is it cosmic? No. People jump up and down, get excited about it? No. But look, when 1 million packages come across the borders every day, and you don't have any information about the contents, if they came through a foreign postal service, there's about 190 of those. You do get information if it comes through UPS or FedEx. Matter of fact, it's that kind of information that led to them opening that package in Yemen, discovered there were 2 explosive devices. So those are that is a threat that I think we have to take a lot more seriously, because it has potential terrorism implications, but huge, huge public health implications, either from a bioterrorism opportunity or, frankly, the destruction of our families and communities, which you can buy illicit synthetic drugs online overseas, and we have no way of even doing a check of some of these packages. So I think that's a vulnerability that bad actors will exploit.
All right. And this must have plagued you when you were secretary as well is until the stuff hits the fan, sorry for the French, no one focuses on it, right? So this idea of trying to get government to be nimble is much harder. It's easier for it to play defense.
Well, you and I know government's not nimble, and you, yeah. you said it very well. But, you know, democracies by nature are soft targets, and democracies by nature, at least in my opinion, were much more reactive than preemptive. And when I take a look at this vulnerability about all these packages coming across the border, I say to myself, well, if we required all shippers through national post office, national post offices to do the same thing we require UPS, FedEx to do, would that narrow the range of potential abuse of the postal system? And the answer is yes. If the aperture of opportunity for bad guys is large, but if you get this electronic data and you subject it to these analytical algorithms in a data-rich environment, you're able to identify packages that are suspicious, and you pull them aside and check them. And you better do that, because the U.S., I think there was a trade act in 2002 where Congress mandated, now this is 13, almost 14 years ago, that there be regulations promulgated and mandate that everybody shipping, National Postal Service, anybody shipping anything in the United States, you have to send it like a manifest in advance. Well, 13 years later, it's unfinished business. So that gap, right, that vulnerability still exists. And it could be a potential public health problem, too, as well as the use of the bad actors, the terrorists.
So 15 years later, you are probably asked this question everywhere you turn, and certainly in the next couple weeks. And I'm curious how you answer it. Are we safer?
Sure. We are safer. I mean, what I try to answer that, because it is a question, you're right, I've been answering it, I will answer as long as I'm alive, and hopefully that'll be answering it for many, many more years. But having said that, the snapshot on 9/11/2001, the actors we think are limited, we can profile them, we think they're geographically confined to a particular space. Fast forward 15 years. Multiple bad actors. It's now a global scourge. Tactics and outcomes are different. So it has become a global condition that I think the country is going to have to deal with forevermore. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't be breathless about it. We should just accept that reality and put that threat in the context of other risks we have as ordinary citizens living in the greatest country on the face of the earth. Labor Day weekend, 400 to 500 people died in automobile accidents. And I don't want to minimize a terrorist attack in San Bernardino and Orlando and places like that. But let's understand that the risk is permanent. It is manageable. Let's consider it in context of other risks to our daily lives and let the professionals go about dealing with it and managing the risk, because God only knows you're not going to eliminate it. And you go back to my concern about the vulnerability of packages. There's a risk. Got it. Can we guarantee that if we have the men, if they send us the electronic data, it will enable us to identify all suspicious packages, whether it's from a terrorist or an illicit drug dealer? No, but it will enable us to narrow that gap and reduce that vulnerability. And at the end, that's what you do.
Well, I want to thank you for your service before 9/11, after, and certainly being a colleague and a friend now. So I want to thank you for your time.
Well, it's been a wonderful conversation. You know, I love having conversations about serious matters in this tone. And you and I have been dealing with the world of risk for a long time, yeah, and we deal with it in a very intimate way. But I do think for the next 15 years, one of the challenges with the political class and media writ large is to put these attacks, and there will be more of them, in their proper context. Right. We haven't done that. And as soon as we better understand that and project it, I think the country will be a lot better off.
Amen to that. Thank you so much, Governor.
Good talk with you. Hope we do this again.
I should mention that Governor Ridge and I work on a joint project to address this gap in our sort of global postal environment that still exists so many years after September 11th. But I also want to reflect on what Governor Ridge did talk about in terms of recognizing that while September 11th was such a tremendous moment in our nation's history, we still have many threats out there, and they change and they will continue to change. And that's why we continue to be focused on this notion of all hazards. Tom Ridge kept mentioning it. This nation has and always will have tremendous threats and vulnerabilities. It's what we are and who we are as a nation. And we need to accept them, and we need to brace for when we can't stop all bad things from happening. So I thought I'd spend just a moment in telling you how I think about our homeland security 15 years after September 11th. I tend to think of it in three different buckets. Maybe because I have three kids, everything ends up being in threes. The first is a commitment to minimizing the risk, whether it's, you know, killing bin Laden or trying to dismantle ISIS or stopping pandemics or gun control or whatever it is to minimize the risk to us and our families and our communities. The second is a commitment to maximizing our defenses, right? Hardening soft targets, trying to protect airports and airlines, making sure that when you go to the next football game, you are safe and secure. And the third is the most important, and that's also about maintaining our spirit as a nation, as people, as communities, as families, is remembering that safety and security is the easy stuff, right? The hard thing is ensuring that we recognize that, right, we also need to be who we are. The flow of people and goods and ideas are what make this nation great and what will make it great into the future. So I don't know what is coming our way in the next 15 years, but I do know with a commitment to working together, we will be able to face it. So let's roll. This is Juliet Kayyem with the Security Mom Podcast. I want to thank my special producer this week, Paolo DeFabio, who put together a not-so-great-sounding podcast. I was on vacation, so excuse the hum in the background. And we'll see you next time. Security Mom is brought to you and produced by WGBH News, and you can catch us on iTunes and just about anywhere else. And visit my website, JulietKayyem.com. We'll see you next time.